Yeah, welcome to Life on Earth. That intro music, I love that intro music because I wrote it, I performed it. But you know what would be really great? We could get a band like Rush to do that. Folks, Anthem of the Heart. It is episode one, part one in a series on Rush. Why do I have an echo here? Let me kill this real quick. Thank you. Sorry about that. We're going to do a series on Rush. And there is no better person to start a series on the band Rush than with the super fan, Jennifer Leyenberger. Jennifer, thank you for joining me. How are you doing on this fine Rush day?
I'm doing great, Robert. Thank you for inviting me.
This is going to be fun. I couldn't think of anybody I more wanted to talk about Rush with to start this off than you, because you are my favorite Rush fan. So not everybody knows. So I'm gonna lay this out, and I know the people who do know want to hear it anyway. Drummer and lyricist extraordinaire. It's hard to say, was he a greater lyricist or a greater drummer? When they're that good, it doesn't even make sense to say who's better than anybody else. Famously inspired by Ayn Rand, Neil Peart, who I used to call Pert. It's Peart. Ask him. Ask Getty. Ask Alex. Neil Peart was famously inspired by Ayn Rand, so much so that, yes, for their second album, Fly By Night, first album that he was with the band, the song Anthem, inspired obviously by Anthem from Ayn Rand, but if that's not enough, and we all know, in fact, Jeff Bannister knows, because he is in with the Super Chat for 2112, yes, a contribution of 2112, two Apple albums later, the album 2112, an entire album side of Sweet, with a plot arc very, very similar to Ayn Rand's novel Anthem. And they weren't hiding it. No. What does the liner notes, Jennifer, say on that album?
It says, to the genius of Ayn Rand. I mean, he did give her credit for it.
Yeah, there was no hiding there. No, yeah. It was to the genius of Ayn Rand.
Yeah, and the story's different. It's not exactly the same by any means. It's a similar theme, but it's totally different in the details.
Yes, completely. And fun. It's kind of fun, even though they give it a bit of a tragic ending there. The idea of, instead of a light bulb, an electric guitar, and playing it out musically. Brilliant. Just brilliant. So real quick, because I know a lot of people are watching right now and will be watching later, and I get it. I understand the excitement for this episode. Super chat. We had super chats before the fact. Jupiter Menace was in with $5, said he wished he could catch it live, but he'll be catching it later. Thank you very much for that, Jupiter Menace. And again, Jeff Bannister in with 2012. And he says in his comments, and Jennifer, you know better than I do where this comes from. Looking forward to the show. Let the truth of love be lighted. Let the light of truth shine clear. Sensibility armed with sense and liberty, with a heart and mind united in a single perfect sphere. Jennifer, where is that from?
Hemispheres.
Hemispheres. So you know much better than I do. Folks, I know Jennifer Leyenberger. I know that her love for Rush is great. And sometimes she'll quote a Rush lyric that I don't even catch. I'm a Rush fan. I obviously, you know from the t-shirt that I've seen them live, but Jennifer, she knows more than I'll ever forget about this band. And Jennifer, I want to jump right into some of the questions that I've got for you. Oh, we have another super chat. Another super chat. I'm sorry. Chris McGraw is in with a super chat. Chris McGraw is a musician. He is a Rush fan. He's a musician who's capable of playing probably all of Alex Lifeson's parts. I don't know. That's a tall order, but he is in with a super chat for 21, 22. Thank you for that, Chris. That is awesome. But Jennifer Leyenberger, I want to know your Rush origin story. And I don't know if you've ever told me, do you recall when you first heard the band Rush?
Yeah, I was about 13. It was because of my older brother. I have an older brother, so I learned a lot of things young because of him. And the first song he ever heard was Xanadu. He actually heard it on the radio. It's unusual back then. I think it was some high school station or something. And he was just blown away by that. So he played it for me, and we were just fans after that. And I remember considering about that song. That song is based on the poem Kubla Khan by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And I was taking an English literature course in eighth grade or whatever it was at the time. And we were learning about Samuel Taylor Coleridge at the time. So I remember taking those lyrics to the teacher and saying, oh, look, there's this song this rock band did about these lyrics, you know, the lyrics that are about the poem. And she read them and she actually said that they were good. And that was one of my earliest memories of the first song, Xanadu. And it's still one of my favorite songs. It would be in the top 10. It's just a masterpiece musically. And it's fantastic.
It really is stunning. And one of the things that amazes me about that song was, I think I first became familiar with it from Exit Stage Left. And I immediately thought, oh yeah, they're doing overdubs, you know, and a lot of bands do. They do a live album, but then they kind of flesh it out a little bit in the studio. And what I found out later, and we'll talk about this, is no, they didn't. They had a work ethic where everything you heard on the stage was either played live or at least triggered by the musicians. You know, even if it was a keyboard part, they were playing with foot pedals. It was all done by these three guys.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about them. A lot of people, you often hear, there's only three guys in that band. I mean, it's hard for people to believe. Yeah, they were very coordinated, definitely. I remember all the foot pedals Alex had. And he even played a little keyboards later on near the end of the career as well on live.
I have to admit, because of the kind of musician I am, I love seeing when Alex is playing keyboards or singing, which he did very little of, but he did when it was needed, he would get on the mic. Very excellent. We got a couple more super chats in already. Oh, nope, just the one, but from Ashley Shrugged, who is in and says, rock on, guys. Great topic. Great band. Couldn't agree more. Yeah, bring on those super chats. Support the Ayn Rand Center UK. I love them for making shows like this possible. And I think we need a little more rock, a little more rocking out, and a little more rush on here. Now, Jennifer, you said Xanadu was your first song. Was it, was your brother like a big Rush fan, or was it just, oh, this is kind of neat, you should hear this?
No, he was totally blown away when he heard that. And he said, who is this band? I have to check them out. So he immediately checked him out, and we went to a concert a few months later, and I went with him, and it was fantastic. I mean, back then we didn't have any money, so we were way up in the stands, you know, or way up in the, but then later we ended up spending lots of money. I was in the first row several times.
Wow.
Yeah. And we traveled all over. We saw them in Canada twice and New York and all over the place.
Do you remember when that first concert was? What year that was?
It was 1981.
81. Mm-hmm. 81. So that would have been Permanent Waves or Moving Pictures?
That would have been Permanent Waves. Yeah. It was before Signals. Yeah. Permanent Waves, Moving Pictures, and then Permanent Waves.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Excellent. Well, I wonder, do you have a favorite like song or album from the band, or probably, I mean, I know you know every album inside out, but because I kind of do, and I wonder if a super fan like yourself, do you have a favorite?
I guess I'd have to say Moving Pictures. It is a fantastic album. And actually their last album, Clockwork Angels, was really great too. They went out on a great note.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was really a stunner, wasn't it? Because,
yeah,
you know, Vapor Trails and Snakes and Ladders, they were good. You know, Snakes and Ladders tour was a great tour. But Clockwork Angels, it just felt like they reached that same pinnacle that they did in the Permanent Waves and Moving Pictures era.
Yeah, and they had a swan song of sorts, you know, the song The Garden, the last song on the album. I mean, to me, it reminded me of The Long and Winding Road from the Beatles. It was like, you know, Paul wrote that. He knew at the time he wrote that the Beatles were breaking up, and that was like his goodbye song. And The Garden was sort of Pierce's goodbye. It was like they knew, you know, he decided he couldn't do it anymore physically. So,
yes. My co-host James Valiant on our Wednesday shows, he is in the chat with a $10 super chat and says, I was front row Madison Square Garden in the early 80s myself.
Oh, wow.
I wonder if you guys might have been at the same show sitting in the same row.
No, we were in Buffalo, actually. When we went to New York, we went to an outdoor venue in Buffalo.
It's one of the things I noticed when I looked up that 2008 tour where this shirt came from, is I had to go through a lot of shows. There was listed on the back of the shirt, I can't believe the way that they toured. You know, small wonder that when even before Peart knew it was the end, when he started slowing down, he's like, I can't keep touring because I can't function at the level that I want to be at.
Yeah, he always said he wanted to quit before he started slipping. He didn't want to show any degradation of his abilities. He wanted to quit while he was still able to do everything, and he knew when that time was. And it's interesting, one of the songs they wrote about related to this, you know the song Losing It?
Yeah, oh God.
Yeah, I mean,
yes, that's always been a heartbreaker.
Yeah, he wrote that song about losing your abilities as you get older, and it makes a reference to Hemingway. And he was 30 years old when he wrote that song. He was a young man. And normally you're not thinking about things like that when you were 30, but he knew that that happens to everybody eventually, unless you die young. And that really is, it's a very sad song, but it's a great song. And they did play that song on the last tour, but only in certain places, because they had the violinist Ben Mink along. Then he was only able to go to certain shows. So we didn't see that live ever, but some people luckily got to see it live in the last tour in 2015.
Yeah, unfortunately, they documented their tours so well. The DVDs are magnificent. That's one of the amazing things about the Clockwork Angels album is the tour that went with it. Mm-hmm. The DVD, I've got the Blu-ray of that, and it's just stunning. You couldn't ask for a better show. The visuals and the TV screens flying around, but used well, not just as a gimmick, just brilliant, beautiful.
Yeah, and it was great how they went backwards. They played the albums backwards from the newest to the oldest, and then they pared the stage down as they went.
Oh, yeah, for the R40 tour. That was amazing.
Yeah, so at the end, they were playing. They had this minimalist stage and playing.
It looked like they're in a high school gym.
Yeah, that was a great idea.
Love that. Yeah, they never let go of their roots. They did the covers album with songs from their youth. Songs mm-hmm. with their own inspirations. That was great fun, too. You know, my favorite band is Yes, so it's irresistible to me that among Geddy Lee's inspirations, he always put Chris Squire out there. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because he would talk about John Entwistle and other, and you would think, oh, yeah, maybe he's just giving Squire a shout-out. But when Yes was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and Chris Squire had passed away by then, who did they get to play the bass? Geddy Lee went up there and played a roundabout with Yes. Too sweet. Too good. Now, one of the reasons why we're on the Ayn Rand Center UK talking about Rush, besides the fact that they are just mammothly excellent, is, as we mentioned, the album 2112, with its connections to the story anthem and the dedication in there to the genius of Ayn Rand, brought a lot of people to Ayn Rand. Who were just, rock fans, knew this band was great, knew that Neil Peart was not just the world's greatest drummer, but an amazing thinker and lyricist, and checked out Ayn Rand. Now, Jennifer, what's your Ayn Rand story? Where did you encounter Ayn Rand?
That's my brother also. It was actually my dad. My dad introduced the books to my brother and my brother to me. And I think it was right around the same time, too. Maybe a year later. I read The Fountainhead when I was 14, so it was like about a year after Rush, and then I went on from there and put it all together. So it happened pretty much at the same time.
Did you take the ideas pretty seriously at that point, or was it more just inspiring?
No, I did right off. It was. Okay. I remember thinking, "Oh wow, this stuff makes sense." Like you read other philosophies and they don't make any sense, and you're like, "Oh, I must not be smart enough to get this." But you read that, and even as a kid, I thought this stuff actually makes sense. It was fantastic.
Excellent. Oh, this is interesting, and not a question I was going to ask, and not in this way. But Jeff Bannister has another very generous 2112 super chat, and says, "Let's see what you think of this. There are three basic phases they went through, and many don't care for the middle phase." And Jeff Bannister says, "I agree, but is it better than most give it credit for? I love the last phase also. Which is your favorite, Jennifer?"
I like all the phases. I know that's a common complaint some people have when they stop being, quote, power trio, which I don't personally think they ever stopped. But when they got in their keyboard phase, like in the mid-80s, and the guitars were less important and for a while. But I thought it was great that they experimented. They tried different things. I thought that was showed how creative they were. They didn't just stick to the same formula all the time. So I liked all of it. I mean, I don't like every single Rush song. There's some that I don't think are that good, but I liked it all. I really did. I liked the different phases they went through. Thought it was interesting.
Yeah, the lyrics never lost their quality. You know, the
No.
style changed. To me, it was funny because it wasn't really the introduction of keyboards that I had a problem with. It was that the guitars started sounding really brittle, kind of cold and angular and almost not distorted enough because it kind of took away the warmth. You know, they were just very biting, very cutting. So I can kind of see what Jeff's talking about there, and I get that about the middle, but some of the best music came out of that phase, and some of my favorite Rush songs are from that middle phase as well. So they never stopped being great. But yeah, I can see why people would have favorites. I can totally get that. Let's see here. Do you know if I asked or if anybody asked you, how many times have you seen Rush live? Do you know how many times you've seen them?
40 times.
I'm sorry, again?
40 times.
40.
40.
40 times.
Yeah.
Or 40 times. Holy
Yeah, it just
smokes.
came out a round number 40. Yep.
Amazing. Well, no regrets. There are times when I haven't seen my favorite bands live and then looked back after they retired and thought, oh man. But yeah, with 40 opportunities to see these amazing musicians, no regrets there. Now, do you have a favorite tour that you saw live? Any concert that stands out where you say, yeah, that one I'll never forget?
There was one in 2012 in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is a smaller town in Michigan. And for some reason, I really remember that one well because it was getting to the point where the audience was starting to change. Where, like, when I was a teenager and you went to the Rush concerts, it was all teenage boys, except for the few girls that were there. And later, like by 2012, you were seeing middle-aged men who were bringing their children, their 10-year-olds, their 12-year-olds. And you just saw the evolution of the audience. And I remember we were like in the second row, and there was a guy there that had a 10-year-old boy with him, his son. And we were talking to him, and that little boy was so excited and so into it and stuff. And that was younger than I ever was listening to that kind of music. He wasn't even a teenager yet, but it was just fantastic. So I remember that particular concert for that reason. It was really great.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm following the chat here, and it's hard to follow the ones that aren't super chats. But Chris McGraw is in there saying some funny things. He says Alex's most creative guitar work was in the 70s. Chris would know because he's a guitar player, much beyond I am. So I will accept that. But he says, and this is interesting to me. He says I was very anti-rock and roll before Rush convinced me it could be intelligent too. Now, what do you
Definitely.
think of that, Jennifer? That makes sense, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. Although I do think there were other bands like Led Zeppelin that were obviously intelligent as well. But the thing about Rush is people, they weren't drug addicts, they weren't drunks, you know, they didn't trash hotel rooms, things like that. They were admirable people as well as just great musicians. Or
Well,
some other
that's what.
musicians like Jimmy Page, well, he was a great musician, but you know, he was on heroin and things like that. You know, he had some issues, but Rush never had that. So you could have the admiration of them as a total human being, as well as being great musicians, which meant a lot to me over the years.
Yes. Yeah, that their personal virtue was extraordinary. There are bands with great work ethics and great musicianship, but you know, Rush were above and beyond that, without a doubt. Now, we've got a super chat. This is a question it would never have occurred to me for this to come up, and maybe that's wrong on my part, but Kindred Amy, I think we know who that is. She put in the $4.99, so the question is, who was cuter when they were young? Getty, Alex, or Neil?
Is that for me or you? No,
I think that one's going to be for you.
that's probably for me. Neil was always my favorite, always. And I actually did love the long hair and mustache phase. I mean, I was just a teenager, but
Mustache, too.
yeah, I was bummed when he shaved it off, but yeah.
It was a very unique, cool. No doubt about it.
Yeah, it was definitely.
Yeah. And Equal to Realities in the super chat. And he says, Rush was the first band I saw live. Well, then everything else is a disappointment after that.
Yeah,
No,
that's right.
kidding, of course.
They
But
ruined everything
man,
else.
that's a tough act to follow. Holy wow. Well, I mentioned the context here is the connections between Rush and Ayn Rand, and not specifically even Ayn Rand, but Rush and Ayn Rand's themes of virtue and independence and rationality. And one of the things that came up on my Twitter channel is somebody said, "Well, Geddy Lee was an objectivist." Well, I think that's overstating it a little bit, but I looked it up, and it's interesting. There are some great Geddy Lee quotes from The Guardian in 2018. There was an article about Rush, and they talk about 2112 was inspired by Ayn Rand, which led to accusations that Rush were right-wing propagandists. And they quote Geddy Lee. He says, "Well, we were very, very surprised. We were very influenced by Ayn Rand, yes, but to me, The Fountainhead was an artistic manifesto. The whole idea of that time in our lives was that we were trying to write original material and we didn't want to compromise. The Fountainhead," again, this is Geddy Lee, not Neil Peart, "The Fountainhead gave me comfort." When that whole thing came out in the press, it seemed to take an odd political bent to it, which wasn't really where we were at. And I love that because, again, from some of the articles, you get the idea that Neil Peart was big on Ayn Rand and the other guys were just going along. But no, they got it. On whatever level they got it, they got it.
Yeah, well, I remember Getty saying once in an interview that he couldn't sing lyrics that he didn't understand and at least somewhat agree with. He said, I can't sing them with conviction and have them come across as that I mean them and I understand them. He said, I can't just parrot words. So he said he used to ask Peart if he didn't understand something, explain to him, what does this mean? So he would know what emotion to put on it, what emphasis to put on it. So he knew what Peart was writing, definitely. He wasn't just mouthing whatever Peart gave him. So there was definitely collaboration there intellectually.
Well, that's a great point. And you're right. You're right. You not only wouldn't Geddy Lee sing lyrics where he couldn't sing them with any meaning, I don't know that he could do it as convincingly as he does. He sings
Right.
like he means it.
Yeah. Yeah,
Excellent.
exactly. Important element in music that they mean it. Just like didn't Ayn Rand say once, I mean it? Well, they meant it too.
Yes. Now, I cross-referenced a couple of sources, including Wikipedia and Discogs, 19 studio albums, 11 live albums. Jeez, that's a lot of live release. 11 compilation albums, although a couple of those were foreign releases. 24 gold records, 14 platinum, 3 multi-platinum. And that would be a stunning career for any group.
Definitely.
One of my screens is pausing. Let me reset that real quick. I do not want to miss any of these super chats. Yes, there we go. Sorry about that. Yeah, and I'm interested to know. Well, I made my own list of why I think Rush may be the greatest rock band there ever was, and tell me what your thoughts on this. The first level is just technical prowess, but as you said, there's a lot of great rock bands out there. So I don't mean to say people want to say Neil Peart was the greatest drummer ever. That might be true, but I think when they get that good, all you can say is these are the greats. These are what's the line that Dave Grohl said? This is the drummer that your favorite drummer looks up to
Yeah.
about Neil Peart. And have you seen any of the videos of Dave Grohl playing 2112, the intro there during the recent tributes?
No, I haven't actually,
Okay.
no.
Folks, you should take a look at that. Go to my Facebook wall. There are some links in the show announcement. Taylor Hawkins unfortunately passed away last year, and big blow broke up the Foo Fighters. And Dave Grohl, being just the nicest guy in rock and roll, put together tribute concerts and got the musicians that were Taylor Hawkins' friends and favorite musicians, and Geddy Lee and Alex Lifeson came on and did the full overture, the suite before the singing starts in 2112. And with Dave Grohl on drums, and to Grohl, it was like, a dream come true to get to play with these guys. Geddy Lee gets up on stage and he's just the nicest guy. And he's like, "Thanks for inviting us," and talking to the audience. And he can be the most commanding rock star and the nicest guy all at the same time. Mm-hmm. Love that.
Yeah, I remember Neil Peart said once that the best, you know, he loved the fans, but the best compliment he could get is from another musician. That meant more to him than anything. Another drummer telling that he was a great drummer.
Yeah. So yes, technical prowess, definitely that level of talent, but you know, ambitious arrangements, just epic arrangements, especially early in their career when they were willing to do a whole album side as one song. But something like Clockwork Angels, which has a theme that runs throughout the album, that is epic. And yeah, have your lyricist co-write a book based on the same story the album's based on. I know they're not the only ones to have ever done that, but they did it brilliantly. Of course, powerful, meaningful lyrics. And for me, and I'm guessing that you feel this too, unlike a lot of rock bands, they had real benevolence. Just there's passion in the music, but there's real joyousness. And you know, songs like Closer to the Heart, Spirit of Radio, Red Barchetta, you just get a big silly grin on your face, especially if you listen to any of these songs with the volume cranked way up and you're driving down the street. Do you have any favorites like that just are your go-to Rush songs if you need to cheer up?
Well, I know Red Barchetta, if I'm driving on the freeway when that comes on, it makes me drive really fast. I gotta be careful about getting a ticket. It really makes you floor it.
I just wonder how many traffic tickets came out of the Golden Earring song Radar Love, and Red Barchetta is right on that list.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you almost want to see those flashing lights behind you when it kicks into the second half of the song.
Yeah, I was going to mention Clockwork Angels. It was loosely based on Voltaire's Candide. And the philosophy of Candide, it was a satire of the philosophy, the German philosophy at the time. There was a philosophy where all is for the best, that the way things are is the best way. So it's basically telling humans not to mess with stuff. It's best the way it is, and don't try to improve it. And Voltaire did not agree with that. So that book is a satire of those ideas. And then Peart, it's loosely translated, but the Clockwork Angels album is about that story.
Yeah. It's great because it's got real cynical themes, just like Candide did.
Yes.
But again, there's still that benevolence. That's every time they criticize something, they're yearning for something better. Every time they criticize, you know, think of a song like, you know, Carney's or The Anarchist.
Yeah.
If there are any anarcho-capitalists in the listening audience here, you need to listen to the song The Anarchist off Clockwork Angels. That just might help you realize, you know, I think I've got all the answers to the world and I am a miserable son of a bitch. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, and again, the song "The Garden," the last song in Candide, in the end, they find happiness by tending their own garden. It's an allusion to your own life and what's important to you, and not letting everyone else tell you what's already there is best. You decide what's best for you, and tend your garden. And that's what that song is referring to at the what happened at the end of Candide.
Yeah, and there's real solace there. Although I love that it starts with Caravan, because there's always the yearning, even on their final album here, there's such ambition, such yearning. Yearning is the word that comes to mind for that. I can't stop thinking big. I can't stop wanting to live large. I just love that.
Yeah. And one of the lines in that song, one of my favorite lines, is going where I want instead of where I should. Doing what I want to do and not what everyone else tells me I have to do. That's a great line.
Yeah, right to the end, those themes were there. Mm-hmm. And Jeff Bannister, in with the chat again. Thank you for your generosity, and says, have either of you read Clockwork Angels, Clockwork Lives, and Clockwork Destiny, trilogy that Neil wrote with Kevin J. Anderson? I have not read the books. Have you read the books, Jennifer?
I read the first one, Clockwork Angels.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think I've got a copy. I just haven't read it, which is a mistake on my part, but now I'll give that as an assignment to myself. Did you enjoy the book?
Yeah, it was good. I mean, I think the album was better, but it was good.
Yes. It is so brilliant with the music that, it seems like reading the book would be a little dry, but I should give it a read. I know I've got it. I bought a special box set when the album came out, and I can't remember what the what was included in the package, but I know I have the book in my library. Well, excellent. Thank you for that, Jeff Bannister. Very much appreciated there. And you see, I didn't even give my whole list of reasons why Rush may well be the greatest rock band there ever was, even in their dark moments, you know, and, you know, Headlong Flight and Red Sector A and losing it. And, you know, much of the final album, even in their darkest, they're not brooding. Even when they're dark, they're not brooding. They're not whining. They're not complaining. They're contemplating something better. Even if it's something better that we've come out of it and come to this state. I always have the sense again that even in their darkest moments, they're yearning.
They didn't pretend that everything's roses all the time. You know, they talked about the times in life that are difficult and how to deal with that and overcome that. And they have a song, Bravado and Roll the Bones. Do you know that song?
I've heard it, but I can't bring it to mind.
Yeah, it's a song about overcoming obstacles, and it has the line that we will pay the price, but we will not count the cost.
Yes. Yes.
So, no, you pay the price, you go through the pain, you do what you have to do, but you don't count the cost. You don't let it destroy you. You don't let it go too deep. You get over and pick yourself up. And that song is the embodiment of that whole idea, you know, that don't let it destroy you.
Yeah. And I love that idea of non-negotiable standards or price, no object. Mm-hmm. And they lived that ethos. And yet at the same time, you know, without going too far or making it too abstract, they rocked out. And with songs that, you know, we could all identify with. I know a lot of people think of them as a young man's band, but I think women just as well can identify with the Analog Kid or Tom Sawyer, because it's not about a guy named Tom. It's about me. It's about all of us. And that sense that, we can live large. We can live larger than the mundane world around us, the people in the subdivisions around us. We can do more. We can be more. I'm sure you personally identified with a lot of it in that way, too.
Oh, yeah, because subdivisions, I was a teenager, so definitely. That was a great song. And it just talks about, you know, the restless dreams of youth. So you recognize that those were there and that was important.
Yeah. Yeah. The sequencing on that album too, taking you from that almost, I was going to say cathartic, but it rocks too hard to be called cathartic. A song like Subdivisions. And who can criticize their keyboards when they were used so brilliantly on that song? So good. But yeah, catharsis, and, you know, we've all been through that, and oh good, somebody else understands what I've been through. But then they go right into the Analog Kid, and you're like, yeah, that's actually me. Yeah, I've been through all this crap, but I'm also that kid, that still innocent, that still yearning, and I'm going to go out and rule the world.
Yeah, they didn't stay down.
And be the new world man.
Yeah. Definitely. And they had some good, it reminds me, in like Subdivisions, for example, they had some good videos that they would play at the concerts. And they had a good video. I mean, they were pretty good at having good videos too. I mean, that's just a added on thing, but their light shows and their videos were really good at times.
Oh yeah. The ambition of their stage shows. Mm-hmm. And it does bring up one thing I wanted to mention. One of the things about Rush that people who aren't fans or haven't been to their shows might not know is that they were funny. They were incredibly funny.
Yeah, they did have some great comedic bits for openers. Yeah, they had Ben Stiller once. That was really funny. And getting Alex would dress up. And the two of them were really funny. I mean, Peart, not so much. He wasn't the greatest actor, I don't think, compared to the other two. But the other two were, Getty and Alex were very funny.
Yeah, they would even when they filmed skits that they would play on the screens behind them, Peart went along with at least some of those.
Yeah.
But yeah, and the cartoons and comics, and you know, the way I would put it is they were incredibly whimsical, even mm-hmm. though they weren't whim worshiping at all. It was all purposive. It was all, you know, thought. But they were incredibly whimsical, and I really admire that about people with that level of talent. They never lost their playfulness.
Yeah, like there's a song called Marathon, which is one of my favorite songs, and the video they did for that at the end, there's like a chorus just singing. And they had a cartoon of little cartoon characters singing the chorus. They had like cats and dogs and little animals singing. So it's a real serious song, but they added that to it in the video, which lifted it up even more. That was great. Touches like that at the live shows were really priceless.
Yep. Oh, in the chat, they're correcting us here. Jerry Stiller, not Ben. That's his dad. Oh, that counts. Jeez.
No, it was Ben Stiller.
Ben Stiller?
No, wait. Jerry's the dad, right?
Jerry's the dad.
Okay, you're right. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Dad, yeah.
Well, you think we're old enough to know who Stiller and Mira were? I'm not that old.
Yeah.
Jeez, you guys.
Yeah, it was the dad. Yeah, that was great.
Nice. Ian Gilmore brought up, Trailer Park Boys. That's.
Oh, yeah. That was really funny, too. That was really.
I've never seen that, but.
Oh, you haven't seen it?
I know they had a great time working with those guys, though.
Yeah, that was funny. That was a good one.
Good stuff. Yeah, whimsical, but not whim worshipping.
No.
And I think some of us need a little more of that. A little more of that in our lives. Now, I'll bring a little bit of controversy in it. And I'm going to do this just because I want to defend Kirk Barbera. Kirk Barbera is interesting. He is a poet. And he's, real got a gruff voice, and he sounds more like a motorcycle rider or something. Actually, I think he is a motorcycle rider, but he's a poet. And he's into poetry and literature and classical music, and he doesn't know much about rock and roll. He's not a rocker. So he found out, or he's discovered over the years of interacting with objectivists, that Rush is the favorite band of a lot of objectivists, or the gateway drug to objectivism for a lot of people. So he decided, I need to listen to Rush. I need to find out, are these guys really as great as I thought they were? Well, I'll tell you this. I'm a fan of the band Yes. Yes is nothing against Rush, but my favorite band. But there's a lot of music by Yes, which the first time I heard it, I'm like, I don't get it. Why are they doing this? Sounds like random notes. It sounds like they're showing off, or they're not even trying. There are songs even by Rush that the first time I heard them, I thought, oh, okay, but I don't really get it. And by the fifth time, it's my favorite song. And I'm like that about classical music. The first time I heard Rachmaninoff's Piano Concertos, I'm like, well, there's a lot of notes, but I don't really get it. Five times in, this is some of the greatest music I've ever heard. So I get it that Kirk Barbera did these videos, listens to Tom Sawyer, does a reaction video to it. He didn't quite get it. He could tell it was good music. He could tell it was a good song. He could tell it was good playing, but people were telling him it wasn't good. It was great. And he didn't understand that. And I got to give him props. I give props to anybody who's willing to take the slings and arrows or snakes and arrows for doing that kind of video. Even though, if it's your favorite band, even, especially I love Moving Pictures in Permanent Waves. It's a little off-putting to hear somebody not get it. But I get that he didn't get it. And in his defense, he did then follow a recommendation of, well, then listen to one of Neil Peart's, because he was listening to the drums and thinking, well, that's great, but a lot of drummers can do that. Listen to one of Neil Peart's live drum solos. And he did that. And in the second video, he gets it. Okay, this is a phenomenal drummer. So I got to give a shout out to Kirk. In fact, I think I want to get him on the show, do an episode with him, talk about those reaction videos, and then, get a little more into why Rush really is the band that every objectivist should be a fan of, but also, relate it to other kinds of music. But I just had to give a shout out to Kirk because he's taking a lot of heat. And Jennifer, as a fan of the Yarn Brooks show, I think we set ourselves up for that. There are people who will actually, they'll send Yarn Brooks a PayPal super chat just to get him to do a reaction video to a piece of music. And Yarn will do it. If you send him $100, he will review any piece of music you want him to. Man, people are setting themselves up for some hurt when they say, Yaron, you've never heard, some complex piece of music, a rock music or some heavy metal, some death metal song. What do you think of this? Do his music reviews usually surprise you, Jennifer? Or have you pretty much got a handle on, okay, if you put this in front of Yaron, this is what you're going to get?
No, I knew. I know what he likes and what he doesn't. I mean, He's pretty much said, people send him rap stuff, I think. And he has said many times, I don't like rap. So it doesn't matter what you're rapping, he's not going to like it. So, and he likes classical a lot. So no, I wasn't surprised, but I know what he likes. So,
yeah.
But
I wonder if you realize a song is so great. Well, maybe this will break through. Maybe this will be the song that makes me realize how great rap is, or for us, how great Rush is.
Well,
sure, no. He doesn't get it, but this is so good, he's got to get it. I get that feeling.
Well, not necessarily. Like rap, he doesn't like rap. He just doesn't like, I don't like it either. I don't like the structure of it. I don't like the way it sounds. I don't like it. So there might be some lyrics that you might think are clever or something. But like, I personally like singing. He likes singing. So probably not, just because of the style of it, you know. But like with Rush, going back to Rush, or like you said, Tom Sawyer, Rush has a lot of versatility and a lot of variety. You didn't like Tom Sawyer, there's a whole bunch of songs, you know, you might like Losing It, you might like Bravado, there's a lot of different sounds. You could like really love one of their songs and not the other. So you would have to sample a lot more than one song with Rush, because they have such variety.
That's a great point. If somebody's not already familiar with the band, definitely listen to a range of songs. And you can ask folks, you can, you know, ask us online, track down Jennifer on Facebook or me, and say, well, you know, I listened to Rush's, and then, you know, whatever the song is, I listened to, you know, Working Them Angels, and I didn't quite get it. And we might come back and say, well, you know, what kind of things do you like? Maybe you should start with Closer to the Heart. Oh, you like, you know, kind of acoustic rock, something that starts off slow and then rocks out by the end, or maybe something that is charming but also cerebral, like The Trees, you know, that has a story to tell.
Yeah, there's always going to be personal taste in there, as there should be.
Yeah,
and you don't have to justify that, you know. But with Rush, there's a lot to choose from. Like when I chose the song, the first song I sent you around, I chose that one on purpose, The Camera Eye, knowing what I already knew about what he likes. I figured this one he might like, and he did. Then when I sent Hemispheres, I told him ahead of time, this was back when Getty's voice was kind of shrieky, you're not going to like that. I told him you're not going to like that, because I knew. And he said, yeah, I didn't like that, but he liked the music and the lyrics and all of that. So again, your taste is your taste. That's fine. If you don't like shrieky voices or whatever, that's perfectly fine. But one thing I've always noticed about Rush, even the critics, even back in the old days when they used to write about how pretentious they were and all of this, if the critic was at all honest, they would admit how well they played, what great musicians they were, and the musicianship that they showed. Even if they didn't like them, it's not my thing, I don't like them, they admitted they played really well, because they do. And that part is pretty objective. Either you play really well or you don't. You know, you don't have to like it, but they recognized how good they were at what they did and how serious they were about being good at what they did.
You know, it's funny, if you had said, well, yeah, what would you send to Yaron Brook if you wanted him to get interested in Rush? I wouldn't have thought of The Camera Eye. And yet that is so perfect that you chose that. It's got,
I put a lot of thought into it, because I was,
yeah. We know he loves New York, but he loves London and he loves cultures. And that song is so evocative, the way it engages the senses, like reading Ayn Rand's narratives.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
And the way that music is structured too, it's
yeah, it's in two sweeps and two parts, yeah, and contrasts and themes. You're right. That was probably the very best thing you could have put before Yaron. Very nice. And I gather that he said, yeah, he liked it. And it's not necessarily his favorite thing, but he liked it.
He said it was good and he liked it, so that was great. And it is one of my favorite songs, I will admit. I have some bias, I guess. That is probably one of my top 10, that song. It's a great song.
Yeah. Excellent. Now, I'm going to throw something out there that, and I'm only doing this because it's a shout out to anybody listening to this episode, because I'm looking for confirmation. There is an apocryphal story, and I'm the one who started it. Back in 1990, I think, at conceptual conferences, first time I ever met Leonard Peikoff, and it might have even been at the breakfast table. I can't remember where he said it, but I remember him saying, because somebody asked him, yeah, well, whatever happened with Ayn Rand and Rush, did she have any problem with Rush using the kind of, you know, the not the specifics, but the plot arc of Anthem in 2112? And it wasn't that big a deal at the time. But Leonard Peikoff did take on the task of going to their lawyer and seeing if there was anything they needed to do to protect their copyright. And is there any action that they should take? Should they be suing PolyGram Records or forget who the record company was? I think that was it. And the way he told the story was that he went to his lawyer, the lawyer that was working for Ayn Rand, explained the situation, and the lawyer said, "Yeah, I can't do that." And Leonard Peikoff said, "Well, you don't think the case has any merit?" And the lawyer said, "No, I just can't do it." And Leonard Peikoff asked why, and he said, "Well, because I'm also the lawyer for PolyGram Records." And so they didn't engage another lawyer. They decided it wasn't that important. They just dropped it. I remember hearing that story, but it was, 33 years ago, and people have asked me about it since I've told the story, and like, I need to find somebody else who has heard that same story. So if anybody out there can verify that, or give me some feedback on that, or anybody knows anybody who was around at the time in relation to that story, please let me know, because you get a memory that you're like, I'm not sure I can trust that memory. It's 33 years old. I know the story, but I'm trying to remember exactly, was it at breakfast? Was it an audience member asked it during the conference? But that was interesting to me because of the kind of arc of Neil Peart and all the guys in Rush, but especially Neil, the professor. We know that he was a big Ayn Rand fan, and he talked about it in interviews. And, yet toward the end of his life, he, I don't know if he distanced himself from the philosophy is the right word, but he said, he explains in his writing that he evolved, that he, kind of grew to believe other things. In the end, he called himself, on more than one occasion, a bleeding heart libertarian. He never lost the sense of, what we might call a small L libertarian of independence and self-responsibility and, making your own way in the world. But that bleeding heart sense too of, well, but he actually, for all that he might have seemed standoff at concerts, you read his books and you read about his family, and he loved people, specific people, the people that were his people. And some people will, say, oh yeah, he dropped Ayn Rand. I don't think he dropped Ayn Rand, not in the sense of, maybe he didn't call himself an objectivist anymore, but all of the virtues that he showed, that made him not just a great drummer, but a magnificent lyricist. And, read his travel tales, is just a great guy. He was just, more of us should be more like that. Those of us who are hardcore objectivists, seven virtues and three values and just by the book objectivist. No, we should all be more like Neil Peart in terms of actually living our lives. And Jennifer, I'm sure you find the trio, but Neil in particular, inspiring too.
Yeah, and the important thing, like I remember reading that interview, and he didn't elaborate. Someone said, "Do you still agree with all of Ayn Rand?" And he said, "No," but he didn't really elaborate on what he didn't agree with. And the important thing to me, though, was the lyrics. I mean, that was his job. That's what he was there to do. And he never wrote lyrics saying how great, collectivism is, or how, everything he wrote before was wrong, and he never said anything like that. The lyrics continued to be consistent, individualism and freedom, and think of yourself, and optimism about man's abilities to make the world better, et cetera, et cetera. That's what mattered, is what the lyrics said. So
Right.
he didn't have to be on paper an objectivist, to be a great man.
Right. Yeah, here's a quote from Traveling Music from one of his books, Traveling Music, the Soundtrack to My Life and Times. This is Neil Peart. To a 20-year-old struggling musician, the Fountainhead was a revelation, an affirmation, an inspiration. Although I would eventually grow into and largely out of Ayn Rand's orbit, her writing was still a significant stepping stone or way station for me, a black and white starting point along the journey of a more nuanced philosophy and politics. Most of all, it was the notion of individualism that I needed, the idea that what I felt, believed, liked, and wanted was important and valid. Now, I'm somebody who, my understanding of objectivism is that it does include all of the benevolent things that Neil Peart thought he had to kind of leave objectivism beside to find. So I don't see any contradiction there at all.
No.
I wouldn't say he was an objectivist at the end, but I would say he was consistent with objectivism right till the end.
Yeah, I think so too, definitely. And that was reflected in the lyrics for sure, and that's what mattered. So yeah, I didn't have any problem with that. I mean, sure, if he was a fully integrated objectivist, that would have been great, but it was great anyway. No, he didn't.
Yeah.
That wasn't his job. He wasn't a philosopher. So.
Yeah, I went to see the Detroit Symphony Orchestra recently, looked at all those musicians on stage, amazing musicians, and thought, I wonder if any of them are objectivists. It just doesn't come up. These are great people doing a great thing. And to look at a band like Rush, who were not just great musicians, but presented amazing themes of a passion and ambition and individualism and independence. Unbelievable to even say, oh, yeah, they should have been, you know, more hurrah about Ayn Rand. No, these were great men. And happily, we still have two of them with us. They're still doing work, even at their age. And Jennifer, do you have any thoughts before we wrap up? I start getting emotional when I think about musicians, you know, musicians who are my age or older, especially, who are still out there rocking out. But yes, any other thoughts or anything you wanted to cover before we wind up here, part one of this series?
I just wanted to say how Ayn Rand, of course, was very important to me when I was a teenager, but so was Rush. I mean, they really helped me get through a lot when I was a teenager and inspired me. And that was so important. And like I said, they didn't have to be perfect philosophically and know how to integrate everything into politics and all that. Just what they were personally to me and what they brought to me just means so much. So I definitely would overlook, you know, he didn't have to be perfect. So.
Well, you are speaking for a lot of us who are, have enormous gratitude to this band, enormous inspiration, and just downright fun. So Jennifer, thank you. Thank you very much for your time. I know we went a little longer than we usually do for Life on Earth, but it was worth it to talk to you about your favorite band of a lot of us. And we're not done. We're going to talk more about Ayn Rand, Rush, and philosophy, but I couldn't think of a better place to start than with Jennifer Leinberger. Jennifer, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Robert. This was wonderful.
Thank you. And that's a wrap. Exit stage left.